From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Maxine Hong Kingston has written two literary memoirs that explored Chinese-American culture and that earned Kingston some of the most prestigious awards in literature. On this edition of Fresh Air, Kingston talks about her latest novel, Tripmaster Monkey, which just came out in paperback. Also today, we talk with novelist Reginald McKnight about being an African-American in Africa. Rock critic Ken Tucker profiles the man who created New Kids on the Block. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Gremlins 2. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. House Republicans this evening failed to muster the two-thirds majority needed to pass a constitutional amendment barring desecration of the flag. The 254-177 vote left the measure far short of the number needed to pass a constitutional amendment. NPR's Cokie Roberts has more from Capitol Hill.
The long day of debate ended with an unusual appearance by the Speaker of the House, Thomas Foley, who concluded by asking his colleagues to keep faith with the Founding Fathers. The standing ovation by Democrats and many Republicans was a moment of near unity following a very divisive day. Republican supporters of the amendment characterized it as a question of values. Did the Congress understand the values of Americans who had fought under the flag or had their fathers and sons buried under it? Democratic opponents insisted the flag was not the issue, the Constitution was. They won today, but amendment supporters plan to take the issue to the voters this fall. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Iran's ambassador to the United Nations now says that yesterday's earthquake killed at least 25,000 people and injured tens of thousands more. Kamal Karazi told reporters in New York that the casualty figures are expected to increase. He said Iran needs medical equipment, blood, blankets, and medicine. He added that Iran will accept aid from any country, with the exception of Israel and South Africa. In Washington, the Bush administration expressed its sympathy and offered to provide humanitarian aid for the victims of the earthquake. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the U.S. is saddened by the damage and loss of life caused by the earthquake and said the White House has sent a message of condolence to Iranian President Rafsanjani. The message, along with an offer to provide humanitarian assistance, was delivered to Iran by a third party, most likely Switzerland, since the U.S. does not have diplomatic relations with Iran. Fitzwater said it's up to Iran to request the aid. Iran has already contacted the United Nations Disaster Relief Office to express its desire for international assistance. Fitzwater said that any U.S. assistance would be, in his words, just humanitarian aid and was not designed to improve relations between the two countries. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
The Supreme Court ruled today that governments can't use political patronage in the allocation of most jobs. The 5-4 decision says that government employers generally may not use someone's party affiliation as a basis for hiring, transfer, or promotion decisions. The court said the only time when political affiliation could play a role in employment decisions would be when it's an appropriate requirement for carrying out a job, such as a high-level policy advisor. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials rose 6.5 points to close at 2,901.73 in moderate trading. This is NPR News. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan predicted today that the U.S. will continue to see modest economic growth. Speaking before the Senate Banking Committee, Greenspan dismissed fears of a recession and said he sees no sign of a nationwide credit shortage. Administration officials and some private economists have expressed concern in recent weeks that tight credit policies could cut off growth. Greenspan acknowledged that some borrowers are having trouble getting loans, but he said that only reflects a justifiable sense of caution by the banks. Banks have turned cautious as their loans have come under closer scrutiny from banking regulators in the wake of the savings and loan debacle. Communist delegates at their Congress in Moscow have adopted a resolution that confirms that their new party will work within the framework of the Soviet Communist Party and obey the laws and constitutions of both the Soviet and Russian parliaments. And after 2 days of fierce criticism, President Mikhail Gorbachev has hit back at those who've attacked his economic reforms. From Moscow, the BBC's Bridget Kendall reports.
Over the the last 2 days, there's been a barrage of fierce criticism from party conservatives who've openly accused President Gorbachev of ignoring the Communist Party in his plans for radical economic reforms. Yesterday, the hardline party leader, Yegor Ligachev, bitterly complained he and other Politburo members had not been consulted, either over the economy or policy towards Eastern Europe. But today, President Gorbachev hit back, forcefully defending his record and reminding his audience that the green light for economic reform had first been given 5 years ago at the last Soviet Party Congress. "No one should think decisions are being taken in secret," said Mr. Gorbachev, and he denounced statements to the contrary as slanderous and simply untrue.
The BBC's Bridget Kendall. The Senate failed by 2 votes today to override President Bush's veto of a bill that would have restored the rights of federal workers to participate in party politics. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Maxine Hong Kingston has written eloquently and movingly about Chinese Americans. Her first memoir, The Woman Warrior, won the 1976 National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. It was about her childhood, growing up in the laundry run by her immigrant parents. Kingston's second book, China Men, was about the men of her family who left China for America. It won the American Book Award for General Nonfiction in 1981. Kingston's latest book, Tripmaster Monkey, is her first novel. It's set in San Francisco in the 60s, and it's the story of a 23-year-old Berkeley graduate and playwright named Whitman Ah Sing. Throughout the book, he keeps up a running commentary on everything he's read, from Rilke to Kerouac, on the movies he's seen, the records he's listening to, and what they say to him as a Chinese-American. Tripmaster Monkey just came out in paperback. I spoke with Maxine Hong Kingston last year when it was first published. She told me why, after 2 memoirs, she wrote a novel.
Well, this is what came to me, and I wasn't thinking about genre at all. It was that this character, Whitman Ah Sing, came to me in my imagination, and I found that I was talking to him, imagining him, arguing with him, and he came to me in dreams, and I followed him around, trying to think of what actions he might create, what kind of a life he might have, and so it's a novel because there is this fascinating person, but he's not a real person.
This person is so different from you are. I was really surprised when I started
reading
your book. Well,
yeah.
I think so, yeah, in the sense that, one, he's a man and you're a woman.
Mm.
He's
fifth
generation Chinese-American.
Yes.
You're first, first generation born in America. He's from a kind of showbiz background.
Yes.
Mother in the Floridora Girls. And you're not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that you chose someone with a really different kind of voice and background from yours.
Yeah, but in many ways the same. I do have people in my family that are in show business, and there's when I think of gambling houses, that's in show business. And Whitman is a young person in the 60s, and I was too, and he's an English major who created himself and his life by reading, and I did that also. Part of him, even though in some ways he doesn't seem like me, his language is my language. After writing those other 2 books, I had a desire to work in a language where I wasn't translating other people from Chinese into English, and trying to find a language of that would beautifully show the people actually speaking in Chinese, and Whitman is speaking the most current American language I could find, and in that sense he's me. He has my education, he has my language.
Well, I'm glad that you brought up his language, because I want you to read a section that I think will show something about the language he speaks and the language that he likes and wants. And this is from early on in the book.
Yeah, this is Witmanah Singh and a girlfriend, and they're walking through Chinatown. And he's thinking, is this it? I mean, what is Chinese-American culture? Do we have any culture? What theater do we have besides beauty contests? Do we have a culture that's not these knickknacks we sell to the Bakwai? If Chinese-American culture is not knickknackatory, look at it. Backscratchers, swizzle sticks, pointed chopsticks for the hair, Jade East aftershave in a Buddha-shaped bottle, the head screws off and you pour lotion out of its neck. Then what is it? No other people sell out their streets like this. Tourists can't buy up J-Town. Wait a goddamn minute. We don't make Jade East. It's one of your Hakujin products by Swank. Would we do that to you? Make Jesus on the cross bottles, so every morning all over the country, hairy men twist his head off and pour this green stuff out of his neck? So what do we have in the way of a culture besides Chinese hand laundries? You might make a joke on that, something about what's the difference between a Chinese hand laundry and a French laundry. Where's our jazz? Where's our blues? Where's our ain't taking no shit from nobody's street-strutting language? I want so bad to be the first bad jazz China man, blues man of America. Of all the music on the airwaves, there's one syllable that sounds like ours. It's in that song by the Coasters. It'll take an ocean of calamine lotion, poison ivy. No, not the ivy part. It's where they sing around. Right there. That's a Chinese opera run. A Coaster must have been among those black guys you see at the Chinese movies and at dojos seeking kung fu power.
Now, you said that this character's voice was a lot like yours. When in the 60s, were you thinking, where's our jazz, where's our blues, where's our street-strutting language?
Yeah, I was thinking, how are we Chinese-Americans part of all this? And I was also, in a wider way, I picked this period that it's the 60s that's before the hippies. It's before the hippies and yippies. It's sort of the dark time after the beatniks and before the hippies. And that was a crucial period. Where are we going? What is the next art that we are going to create?
You know, the voice that you have the character speaking in is this really macho swagger kind of voice.
Yeah.
Where language is style and there's this boldness in it. And I think back to your book, your first book, The Woman Warrior, and talking about how you really hated school because you had to speak.
Yeah.
And you had a small
yeah.
voice and you hated to speak.
Yeah.
And you still speak pretty quietly, I have to say, hearing you speak now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a lifelong struggle to find the voice of the writer and also to find voice as a human being and all kinds of voices, political voice, the bravery to speak up, the ability to create myself as a person. All of that has to do with finding voice.
Do you have a different voice in your mind than you do vocally?
No, it's pretty much the same one.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Although as I read this, I remember that one language habit that I bring back, that I bring from the 60s. You know, I chose this period also because I love the language that was being formed. I mean, these words that people were inventing in order to describe new psychedelic states and visions for the new society, words that would describe the Zen gestures to bring about civil rights and to bring about the end of the war in Vietnam, all these flower power words. I mean, I wanted to write about that period because of the language of the time. And And I see that the words that I still use are, I mean, I look at something and I just say, oh, wow. I mean, I think people have forgotten now. That used to, people used to say that all the time. Oh, wow, and beautiful.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Maxine Hung Kingston, who's written a new novel called Tripmaster Monkey. I'm thinking back again to The Woman Warrior, where you wrote that you had to change your voice to be American feminine.
Mm-hmm.
What was the difference between the Chinese female voice and the American feminine voice in your mind?
Well, what I was thinking about there is that the women around me, my mother and people of her generation, the people who came from the peasant villages of China and then came to America and worked in the fields in the San Joaquin Valley, I mean, these women have such strong voices. They shout. They don't have social shame. You know, they can go into a library or any elegant place, and they unself-consciously yell at one another. And they don't think of it as yelling. It's just good, strong, loud peasant talking and communication. And in comparison, I could see that American women who are feminine have soft, sweet, nice, quiet voices, and I was wondering, well, how can I speak? If I speak like my mother, then it's so unattractive. But if I speak softly, like the American girls that I saw around me, then it's not loud enough, it's not powerful enough. So how do I speak? So that was the problem I was wrestling with in that book and at that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, one more thing on the subject of speaking. You also tell the story of how when you were a baby, your mother cut the frenum, which is that little string-like muscle that connects the tongue to your mouth.
Yeah, so she says that she did that, yeah.
She says that she did it to loosen your tongue and so that you could speak in any language.
Yeah.
Now, you don't. You were very young, if this indeed really happened. You don't remember it happening.
I sort of remember, and I think it might have been because she might have done it to another one of the kids. So I sort of remember seeing it, but I don't know.
To me, it's this incredible image of metaphor and reality really mixing. You know, it's a nice metaphor to like loosen somebody's tongue, but to do it in reality by slicing into it.
I actually think she did it in reality because my mother is, while a very imaginative woman, she's also entirely real, and she's very good at bringing dream and vision into reality, creating reality.
When she told you that she'd done that, what was your first reaction?
I had a lot of paranoid feelings, too. I thought, also, what if she made a mistake and she cut my tongue and then I can't speak? What if that happened? What if the results of that backfires? And maybe that's why I don't speak well.
And is this the kind of thing you could actually talk with her about?
Sometimes, very indirectly, or when I feel very brave, I'll bring up something. Or just recently, I asked her, maybe it wasn't even me, but sometimes I get a lot of backup now from my sisters and from the nieces, and who are, now they're like second, third generation Americans, and these nieces read my books, and then they get very curious, and they want to go over to Grandma, and they want to know. There were a bunch of them, and they were saying, this ghost that sat on your chest, I mean, did that happen? What was it like? And then my mother says, then she gets right away. She goes into her talk story, and she tells them about how it sat on her chest. It was so hairy, and she says, and there was this foot sticking out of it. And I'm thinking, well, why didn't she tell me there was a foot? Then I could have gotten it into the book. See, she still keeps remembering details or making it up or whatever, but there's this constant change and aliveness.
Well, let's talk more, but first let's take a short break first. My guest is Maxine Hahn Kingston, and her new book is her first novel. It's called Tripmaster Monkey. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer Maxine Hahn Kingston is my guest. Her literary memoirs, The Woman Warrior and Chinaman, were landmarks in Chinese-American literature. She's now written her first novel, Tripmaster Monkey. You grew up with your mother doing talk story. Would you explain what that is?
Well, it's a Chinese cultural tradition that I imagine goes back to pre-literate times when people passed on culture and ideas and philosophy and how to do things by putting them into stories. And I think the form is so wonderful because every time you tell a story, the story changes. The same person can tell the same story, and each time it's different because you look at the child, you look at the person that you're talking to for cues. What are they? What do they need right now? Do they need a scary story? A story of that would admonish them? Do they need a rite of passage story? Do they need a soothing story? And the story changes moment by moment as you look into the other person's face. These are the stories that became the basis for Three Kingdoms, for Monkey, and for all those Chinese novels and operas. First, they were talk story. There are modern ones, and they are also, you come home from work and you tell the story of what happened to you today. Talk story keeps a community together. My parents, the laundry, you know, people would come in with letters from professional letter writers in China. They read them aloud. This is the community, knowing one another's business. And talk story keeps a community alive.
Growing up, you really felt that in Chinese culture, girl babies and girls weren't valued in the same way that boy babies and boys were. And you rebelled against that in several ways and mm-hmm. rebelled against the expectations for girls. You didn't want to be a slave or a wife.
So you
learned to cook badly intentionally. You used to crack dishes sometimes when you'd be forced to wash them.
Yeah.
And we talked earlier about how you were kind of torn between, like, being a Chinese woman and American feminine and what the requirements of each were. What was it like for you when you were exposed to feminism and there was a kind of third alternative of what a woman could be?
Actually, there was an alternative from the beginning, which I didn't recognize until I became stronger and wiser. Because at the same time that my mother would talk story about the conditions of slavery in China, she all along was giving me the chant of Fa Moklan, the woman warrior. I mean, this was one of the ways I learned to talk. I was chanting the chant of the woman warrior. And so all along she was saying, there is this other way to be, of being very masculine, of going into battle and fulfilling filial obligations by taking your father's place in battle. You could almost be a man. There's a history of swordswomen in China. And actually, we were going to the kung fu movies all the time, where it's always Angela Mao that wins in the Bruce Lee movies. Bruce Lee loses battles. once in a while, but Angela never did. And so I had that all along. But so when I came to feminism, actually, I felt that, oh, here are people who think the same way I do. It wasn't that I was exposed to new ideas.
I imagine it was somewhat painful and disconcerting to your parents to watch you grow up in America without a real firsthand understanding of the culture that they were from in China, just as it is for so many immigrants who come to America and watch their children grow up in a different culture from the one they grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've watched your children grow up more assimilated than you were. Or at least that's what my guess would be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what that's been like for you.
Well, I have one child.
Okay.
And a boy. And he's about Witmanaw Singh's age. And actually, I don't think anybody assimilates. Nobody assimilates. The task is, how do you integrate very many different elements? This is a task of all of us. We all live in a multicultural America now. And how do we integrate all of its elements? I mean, how do I integrate this Chinese-American past and the life of in the 60s? How do I integrate the Vietnam War into my life? And my son, actually, he has solved this in such interesting ways. I mean, we took him to Hawaii and raised him mostly there. And here he is, a Chinese, Jewish, Portuguese, Irish, American. And I think that the more elements you have to fight, to struggle, to integrate, the more complex and interesting new personality and culture you come out with. And I see that the way he has solved it is he has become a Hawaiian, and he sings the ancient Hawaiian songs and plays the music. And that is the way they communicate in their culture. They have talk story, they have the chants, they have the hula, and they have the music. And if you do those things, you are a Hawaiian. And that makes me realize that all of this isn't done by race. It's done with culture. We communicate with communities.
Maxine Hong Kingston. Her novel Tripmaster Monkey just came out in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, comic actor and writer John Cleese and his former therapist, Robin Skinner, they collaborated on the book Families and How to Survive Them. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Many African Americans go to Africa in search of the African part of their identity. There's a new novel about a black American who goes to Senegal and finds himself alienated and lost. Coming up, Reginald McKnight on his new novel, I Get on the Bus. The teen rock group New Kids on the Block has sold millions of albums and who knows how many t-shirts, posters, and keychains. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker tells us about the man who invented New Kids on the Block. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Gremlins 2. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the House has turned down a proposed flag-burning amendment and killed its chances for passage this year. The 254-177 vote in favor of that amendment was 35 votes short of the two-thirds needed for passage. House Speaker Thomas Foley says that the amendment will not be brought up again in the House this year, even should the Senate vote on and approve it. The government of Iran says more than 10,000 people were killed when an earthquake measuring 7.7 on the Richter scale struck the northwest part of that country. An Iranian diplomat at the UN has put the figure as high as 25,000. Mike Theodoulou has this report.
An emergency cabinet session described it as a sad, painful, and horrible tragedy. Dozens of villages and towns were flattened in the mainly rural provinces of Zinjan and Gilan, northwest of Tehran. All government organizations are on red alert, and an air bridge has been set up between Tehran and the stricken areas. Helicopters and transport planes are bringing in medical supplies, food and clothes, and returning with casualties. It's dark in Iran now, but rescue teams will work through the night. Several hundred Revolutionary Guards have been flown in to help. The government is said to have requested international assistance, and despite Iran's diplomatic isolation, several Western countries say they will provide humanitarian aid if asked, including the United States. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodoulou in Nicosia.
In Washington, the State Department is urging Americans who travel in the Middle East to use extra caution because of rising tensions in the region. George Gatta has more from the State Department.
The notice to Americans came just a day after President Bush suspended the U.S. dialogue with the Palestine Liberation Organization. The State Department said the advisory was being issued even though there were no specific threats against Americans. 3 weeks ago, a similar appeal to American travelers was made after terrorists threatened to attack American citizens or U.S. installations. Bush suspended the dialogue after the PLO refused to denounce an abortive Palestinian attack near Tel Aviv. After Bush's statement, PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat warned that the president's action would produce a loathing of Americans among Arabs. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
Also in Washington, the Pentagon has asked Congress to cancel 68 U.S. military construction projects worth over $327 million. Most of the affected projects are in West Germany. A worldwide freeze of $6.7 billion worth of military projects continues. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 6 points to close at 2,901.73 on volume of 140 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The group New Kids on the Block just came out with a new album called Step by Step. It entered the charts at number 14. That's the highest debuting album since Madonna's Like a Prayer in the spring of 1989. Rock critic Ken Tucker takes a look at producer and manager Maurice Starr, the brains behind the New Kid's success.
Step by step, ooh baby, gonna get to you, girl. Step by step.
Dismissed by grown-ups in the great tradition of teen idols, New Kids on the Block is a first-rate example of an adolescent rock act. They're cute, they're lovable, and they're the creation of someone else, in this case, manager-producer Maurice Starr. Starr is a master knockoff artist. A decade ago, he invented New Edition, which was conceived as a fresh version of the Jackson 5. Then Starr created New Kids on the Block as a white version of New Edition. As a black man, Maurice Starr understood all too well that a white group that sounded like a black group would sell more records in a country as addled about race as America is. He was right. Their voices may be thin and their material wispy, but there's a bedrock tradition to the New Kids' songs that I find difficult to dislike. That tradition is rhythm and blues, and these five blue-collar kids from the Dorchester section of Boston do their best to emulate R&B acts like Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, the Delphonics, and the Stylistics. Let's Try Again is, in fact, a pretty close approximation of the Stylistics' 1972 hit, Betcha By Golly Wow. New Kids on the Block isn't the only act Maurice Starr is overseeing these days. He also has Perfect Gentlemen, a trio with a big hit, Ooh La La, and a young lead singer named, Maurice Starr Jr.
I remember the day, it was oh so sad. She was the sweetest, dearest friend I ever had. She could talk to me almost any time, and at the end of my day, I felt fine. Her mother news to my heart. She said they're leaving, and now I'm tearing all apart. I think I'll never forget that day. And for you, girl, this is all I have to say.
And then there's the Superiors, five young fellows whom Starr has said he's modeled on the Temptations. Sure enough, they have a song called Temptation that sounds an awful lot like, well, you'll hear it, I'm sure. As you've probably figured out for yourself by now, Maurice Starr is no creative genius, but he's something better than a cynical manipulator. To write and produce every song on these albums, as he's done, and locate the talent to perform them, and have them all become hits, well, that's a combination of creative and business skills that any corporation would envy. Right now, Starr's cash cow remains the New Kids, with 15 million albums, singles, and video cassettes sold, and 2 million copies of their new album shipped to record stores. And, oh yes, Starr says he's got another star in the making. He signed a skinny white kid with a big voice named Rick Wess. Maurice Starr says he's going to be, quote, the new Elvis. And at this point, I'd be a fool to argue with him.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Happy birthday to you. This is your day. On this day for you, we're gonna love. Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I Get on the Bus is a new novel about a middle-class African-American man who joins the Peace Corps and goes to Africa because there's nothing for him in the U.S. After 3 months, he decides his Peace Corps experience is pointless. And although he feels lost in Africa, he won't go home before his 2 years are up. A sudden illness brings him to the home of a healer in Senegal. Here he starts to understand the African part of being an African-American. I Get on the Bus is Reginald McKnight's first novel. His short stories have won the O. Henry Award and the Kenyon Review Award for Literary Excellence. McKnight spent a year in Senegal on a research fellowship. He went there to interview African writers about the influence of folklore on their work. This is a passage from the first part of McKnight's novel, I Get on the Bus.
When I am sick of Africa, I go to a hotel. I always try to find the most Western-looking hotel I can afford. No stewards, bellmen, or desk clerks in traditional dress. No traditional African art all over the walls. I go somewhere that serves hamburgers and fries, pitiful as they may be, where the staff speaks relatively decent English, pathetic as it may be. After checking in, I buy copies of Time, Newsweek, Playboy, the Herald Tribune. I buy a pack of Winston's Coke or Pepsi, chips, oatmeal, cookies, anything American, junky, too salty, too sweet. Anything not African. I hole up for 2 or 3 days, stink up my room with the cigarettes, the junk food, American sweat and vibes. They'll know damn good and well, I tell myself. A Yank's been here when I walk out this rat box. I try to Americanize the room so deeply they will have to seal it up forever. But tonight I buy only cigarettes. I lurch up to my room, lock the door behind me, and pace, stopping to stare out the window every now and then. It has begun to rain. I see nothing but streetlights, headlights, and the glimmer of the wet streets.
You know, that paragraph has the kind of alienation that you don't expect to find in a novel about an African-American who goes to Africa.
Well, yes, that's true. Evan certainly does have an attitude. But there are African-Americans around who do feel this way, I think. I was always discombobulated. My head was always spinning. There's just so much to take in. It's just so different from what we see, even in a city with the complexity of New York. There's no comparison, really.
Did you ever find yourself checking into Western-style hotels when you were in Africa?
No, I never did, but I did try to, from time to time, surround myself with the accoutrements of my class and of my culture. But it was sort of a mixed bag. I mean, unlike many Westerners that I knew in Africa, I lived in a village and I ate with families all the time, usually the same family, I should say. I touched everything, I tasted everything. That's probably why I got sick as hell so often, but it was worth it. There are times when there's such an overload of the senses that you need to retreat, and I generally retreated by writing.
You had malaria and hepatitis.
Yes.
When you were in Senegal. Did you use folk remedies or?
Yeah, I did. I did use folk remedies. I went to the malaria was initially treated with a shot of chloroquinine or whatever the heck it's called. And it was just turned out that the person from whom I was renting a room in the village happened to be a physician's aide, and he gave me a shot of that, and it helped to break the fever. But the headaches continued for quite some time, and they still reoccur from time to time. But generally, I drank this stuff called Kinkiliba tea. It's a sort of tea that is sort of a mellow. To me, it has a mellow flavor to it, and I remember it being red in color. And I drank a lot of that. I drank this concoction of a tablespoon of green clay, argile vert, in a 8-ounce glass of water. God knows why. That was for the hepatitis. I don't know. I guess it worked. I mean, I'm still standing up. My kidneys probably don't work as well. But I drank this mud down and other herbs and things.
Your character has malaria.
Yeah.
And he stays with a family.
What looks like malaria, but we're not really sure.
Right, okay. Because so much of the story is a hallucination anyways.
Uh-huh.
But he, we think, stays with a family where the father and husband is a medicine man. And he ends up taking all these African folk remedies, but he's very untrustworthy of them initially. He wants to know what's in everything and what it's going to do. What was your experience like taking folk remedies? Were you... did you want to know what all the ingredients were, what to expect? Did you trust them at first?
They say that God protects babies and fools, and I was both, 26 and a real idiot sometimes. And I trusted pretty much everybody I met, just sort of this, moon-eyed innocent. And I think for the most part, people were very nice and very straightforward about things and honest. And as open with me as I was with them, and then there were others who weren't, and it taught me a lot about people. I mean, I learned how to Africans don't spend and Evan says this in the book. I remember writing this scene. Africans don't spend a great deal of time watching television. Television runs a couple 3 hours a day. They don't spend time playing Space Invaders or Teenage Mutant Ninja whatever. In some arcade, they spend time with each other.
Well, as a matter of fact, in that paragraph that you're describing, he says that that's why they're more literate in how humans are than any other people. And let me read some more from that paragraph. You write, "It's so strange for a black person to leave America, where one is looked through yet feels conspicuous, then come to Africa, where one is most assuredly conspicuous and feels seen through."
Yeah.
Is that the experience you had?
Oh, yeah.
how seen through? What?
People could tell if you were in trouble. They could tell if you were vulnerable. They could tell if you were a dupe. They could tell if you were a patsy or a sap. Or they could tell if you were a very nice person. They just understand people better than we do. We spend a great deal of time in this world listening to scripted language, and reading things and watching things that are, prepared for the public domain. I found in Senegal that the public and the private domain sort of ran together like a double helix. And people understood very often your intent, no matter what you claimed you wanted to do. And I had to learn how to discern people. I had to learn how to look people in the eye. And, I was existing for a great much of the time on a a linguistic level. I didn't speak, as I say, the languages, and I had to learn how to read people. And I learned how to read people by watching other people read other people.
When Evan gets to Africa, the children there call him Tubab, which means either white man or stranger. And it's like he's such a stranger, being an outsider, he might as well be white in Africa in the eyes of these children.
I really think that there are some people in Africa, who think of Americans as Americans, just this general, and some happen to be a darker hue than the others, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're wholly African. There was some distance there, here and there, not with all people, but sometimes I don't believe that referring to an African American as Tubab is meant, particularly by children, as pejorative. I think it's just, you have to sort of take it for what it is. It's a description.
For your main character, the trip to Africa becomes part of his search for his own African-American identity. Did it end up being that for you?
You know, I didn't really have those intentions, actually. And I should tell you also that I was very intimidated about going to Africa. I had studied African literature in college, that's what I majored in, and that was comfortable. But you know, actually going out into the world, going to Africa, and with the hope of meeting some of the writers I'd been reading, and at the very least, just living among the people who these writers are writing about, I, for one hand, I thought I would fail at the whole project, and in a sense, you could say I actually did, because I never did any of the research. But at the same time, it was a powerful experience for me in many respects, not just in terms of my ethnic heritage, and is still, I think, the central point of my. My work, that experience in Africa, really changed me more than the military did, more than all the other usual rites of passage that young people make in this country.
Reginald McKnight, his novel I Get on the Bus is published by Little Brown. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have on the earthquake in Iran?
A terrible earthquake in Iran. At least 10,000 have been killed, many more than that wounded. We'll have a first-hand description of the earthquake from the time it started, 12:30 a.m. in Tehran. Also a conversation with a Red Crescent relief coordinator in Tehran about the rescue efforts. Nelson Mandela speaks in Harlem today. We'll have two reports on Mr. Mandela's day in New York City. He's the president of the African National Congress. Also, it's Thursday, and we'll have letters from listeners and a conversation with music writer Daniel Oakland. He says, the greatest album ever made is by John Coltrane and the singer Johnny Hartman.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's been 6 years since slimy, obnoxious creatures terrorized a small picture postcard town in the movie Gremlins. Now the little monsters are back and multiplying in Gremlins 2, The New Batch. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
The very idea of a sequel makes most of us turn up our nose. But in one way, a sequel has it all over the original. If the premise is complicated, and in these movies it usually is, the original always has to spend a lot of time developing it. In the case of Gremlins, for instance, we had to see the little Frank Capra-style town. We had to learn about the movie's central family, and then we had to discover the furry little animal called the Mugwai that the father bought from some old Chinese sage. Finally, of course, we had to learn the rules about not letting the Mugwai get wet and not feeding it after midnight, all of which obviously took time. But in Gremlins 2, this stuff is reestablished in a flash, and the movie can zip right into its own deliriously hyper world. The setting is New York City, mostly inside a financial empire a lot like the Trump empire. And the pace is very fast, very jazzy and irreverent and hip. The movie's Trump is called Clamp, and he's played with a wonderful combination of ingenuousness and sleaze by John Glover. His tower is full of high-tech gizmos that don't quite work. And wherever you go, voices tell you things like, have a powerful day. And behind one door, a speaker blurts, Mister, welcome to the men's room. I sure hope you wash those hands. Upstairs, where they do biological experiments, cows are being forced to listen to self-help tapes that say, I enjoy giving milk. I enjoy giving milk. And nearby, under the malevolent gaze of Christopher Lee, who used to play Dracula, the poor little Mugwai is about to be experimented on. That's when our hero, Billy, played by Zach Galligan, finds him and helps him escape. And that's when the poor thing accidentally gets wet. Before Clamp and his henchmen know it, the whole building has been invaded by the Mugwai's accidental offspring, those scaly, pointy-eared, ferociously mischievous creatures known as gremlins. Billy tries to stop them, but he's mistaken for a saboteur and he's arrested. And even after he's released, of course, nobody believes him.
Sir, you've got to evacuate the building.
Not the suit, please. Evacuate the building? Why is that?
There are creatures in it, sir.
Creatures?
Yes, well, at least they start out as these small furry animals, and then what happens is they eat after midnight. They metamorphose, and they form these cocoons.
Peltzer, you're having a psychotic episode. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Sir, you've got to listen to me.
Wait a minute. This is good. First they start out furry, then they have cocoons.
Well, no, they eat, and then they go into the cocoons.
Yeah, well, sure. You're going into a cocoon. You want to have a little something first.
Joe Dante, who directed the first Gremlins, is on hand again here. But he's in a much jollier, less mean-spirited mood. Working from a tangy script by Charlie Haas, Dante keeps his gremlins as nasty and childish as any good projection of the id should be. But he doesn't linger over their evil-doing, and he packs so many gonzo movie and pop culture references into the mayhem that the movie feels like some kind of vast, crazy game show. It keeps quizzing you and then rewarding you for getting the right answer. Dante and Haas seem never to have suffered from a script conference. There's no idea so weird that the movie isn't willing to let them go out on a limb to pursue it. And by the middle of the film, when Dante pulls a trick so audacious that you feel like your brains are falling out, the movie has convinced you thoroughly that anything can happen. Bring the kids or don't. After all, anarchy is for grown-ups, too. But of all the blockbusters the summer has unearthed so far, Gremlins 2 is the one you've got to see.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Richard Parker, and Orji Voblaitis. Chris Burgin directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, comic actor and writer John Cleese joins us with his former therapist. They collaborated on the book Families and How to Survive Them. And we talk with novelist Richard Ford. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.